You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On this episode, I welcome back our good friend, Carl Marshall, from the Centre of Fortean Zoology, to dive into the world of zombies, both in reality and in popular culture. We discuss a couple of notable cases from Haiti, and the investigations into the zombie phenomenon, before discussing some of our favourite films from the zombie genre. Carl then also gives us an overview of the upcoming Fortean Film Festival, in which he is a judge, as well as some updates from the Centre for Fortean Zoology, and some alien big cat talk too. As always, it's a pleasure speaking with Carl. Before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for $4 a month. Ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. The link is also in the show notes as usual. You can follow Mysteries and Monsters on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for early releases, updates, news, and merchandise by using the tabs at the top of the page. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let us peel back the curtain and dive into the world of the zombie. On this episode, we welcome back Carl Marshall, Assistant Director of the Centre of Fortean Zoology, to dive into a topic that we've yet to have covered in depth, and that topic is the world of zombies. Carl, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
I'm very well, Paul. How are you?
Yeah, we're all right, mate. We're all right. Fighting fit and looking forward to the rest of the year and what it's going to throw at us. Who knows?
Indeed, yeah.
So, as I mentioned in the introduction, this is a subject that I've touched on a couple of previous episodes, most notably with Alison Jordan in regards to some of the work that female investigators have done over the years. But the zombie is one of those things that I think seems to have once again grown into this sort of genre-spanning trend now, that it's probably never been as popular as it has now, even though, as a lover of horror and classic cinema, Carl, the zombie is one of those that's kind of been there a long time as well. So, for you, what is it about zombies and the history of the zombie that attracted it to you? Because I know you've got a real love of this subject.
Yeah, I've just always found it fascinating, you know, the origins, the West African origins. Yeah, the zombie comes from the spiritual beliefs of many different peoples in West Africa, and also, to a certain extent, the west coast of Southern Africa, where the word Nzambi is used. And that's actually a sun god. It's a sun god of the Bakongo people of Angola. But interestingly enough, the word zombie in the form of zombie without the E is actually first recorded in 1819 in the history of Brazil by the poet Robert Southey, where he was actually referring to an African-Brazilian rebel leader named Zumbi and the etymology of his name. So, you know, it goes back a lot further than just, you know, Hollywood and that kind of thing.
Well, yes, I think often when it comes to the zombie, a lot of people, quite wrongly, suspect that this is more to do with a cinematic creation rather than an actual historical narrative. And what I've always been interested in is that if you look at what a zombie is supposed to be, essentially, depending on your cultural leanings, you can kind of look at it from two separate strands, really, Carl. Like you say, there's a lot of belief that comes over from West Africa and was later adapted by certain Caribbean countries, notably Haiti.
Yep.
But also, you've got parallels that go all the way back to some of the earliest recorded writings, because I know some people look at the epics of Gilgamesh,
from Mesopotamia, and I believe it's Ishtar, the goddess, that a lot of people kind of think that that's the real first kind of indication of what a lot of people would consider to be the zombie, which is the dead rising from the grave to feast on the living.
There's definitely a link with, like, the European revenant. You know, there's definitely a crossover between the mythology of the vampire and the mythology of the zombie. You know, they do go sort of hand in hand at some point. And, you know, so from the 16th to the 19th century, when those, you know, those poor Africans of various different cultural groups with their own beliefs were forced into slavery and then shipped to the island of Hispaniola, now Haiti and the Dominican Republic, they came together under the hardship and cruelty of the slave trade, and obviously eventually they formed a fascinating new religion made up of various West African beliefs and Catholicism, which had been forced onto the slaves in an attempt to, quote-unquote, civilise them.
Mm. Absolutely, as we often see with many a culture, and the overriding archetypals of trying to make people conform to what their masters wish them to follow, Carl. And it's often when things like this happen that things become subjected to change, and they go underground and hide away from the glare of the authorities. And often, and I've been fortunate enough, I went to a lecture a couple of years ago, and one of the particular aspects of one of the talks was featuring a breakdown of the film Get Out. And there was a lot of parallels that they were using in Jordan Peele's film, that the lecturer was basically sort of encapsulating all this history and the tragedy of the slave trade, and the fact that Get Out was using kind of a mixture of these kind of ideas that had their links in slavery, but also that he was looking towards the influence of voodoo on the film and the zombie myth, even though to most intents and purposes you would not think of either of those two aspects of the horror genre being part of Get Out. And I found that very interesting. It was also very interesting that he was discussing the two different types of voodoo as well, voodoo and voodoo. So
yeah,
for a lot of people, I think subjects like this, Carl, seem to be there's like an amalgamation of what it actually is into a kind of bite-sized version of it. When you peel all the layers back, as you say, there is far more to the zombie mythos and the zombie history than what most people would suspect, I believe.
Absolutely. I mean, voodoo is a hybrid religion of Central African beliefs and Catholicism. Literally, the Catholic saints have become merged with the lower, which are voodoo spirit.
Absolutely. So, what was it that drew you into it, the subject indeed? Because I know a lot of us who have an interest in Fortean subjects and strange histories, and as you touched on there, there's a lot of parallels with the Revenant and things. So what was it about the zombie that appealed to you so much, Carl, rather than just looking at it in a cinematic sense, looking at it in an actual historical context?
Well, you know, as a cryptozoologist, I'm very interested in culture, you know, and the Haitians have a very different definition of death, which I find quite fascinating. To the Haitians, the human soul is made up of two separate spirits. The first is called the Tibonage, which literally means the good little angel. And that constitutes the intelligence, the personality, the conscious, that kind of thing. And the other part is referred to as the Gros Bonage, which is literally translated as the big good angel. And that's like everything else. So the Bokor, which are voodoo witch doctors, and they shouldn't be mistaken for voodoo priests, I should probably point out, like such as Max Beauvoir, they have the ability, according to folklore, to remove the victim's tibonage, essentially leaving the individual as a shell with no personality, which is their definition of a zombie.
I mean, that's the other aspect as well as this, is that this has been going on for generations and centuries, Carl, and yet it only seems to have started to be viewed as culturally important from about 100 years ago. When you look at some of the writings that went on in the 1920s, and obviously probably one of the most famous proponents of the zombie myth, and the actual one of the most well-known cases was a lady called Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
Now, Zora is one of those people that sadly, this day and age seem to have been forgotten for a very long time and has sort of gone through some kind of renaissance over the last 20 years, as she quite rightly did. And I found it quite shocking that we almost lost all her writings and her catalogues, because people, she basically sort of disappeared from scholarly review, and people just didn't seem interested in her work. When we look at it now, Carl, it's culturally significant and it's deeply important work. So for anybody that's unaware of Zora and what she brought in regards to one of the most famous cases of modern zombie, can you sort of dive into that and what the cases that sort of Zora revealed to the world for everyone?
Zora, she was basically a very early researcher who travelled to Haiti and investigated the situation on the ground. Because there aren't many that have actually done that. One of the famous one would be Wade Davis back in the 1980s. He was doing a similar sort of thing, but from a more scientific approach. Probably the first one, the most famous person associated with the zombie, is probably William Seabrook. He was an American journalist, an explorer, and an occultist, known for introducing the concept of the Haitian zombie to the rest of the world in 1929 in his book The Magic Island. And also writing on and dabbling in cannibalism, which is something that he actually did. Anyway, The Magic Island, Seabrook discusses an encounter he had with a Haitian friend named Polynice. I don't know if you've heard that story.
No.
Polynice actually showed him three apparent zombies. Seabrook had been skeptical of the story Polynice had told him about a group of zombies that had returned from their graves in 1918, I think it was. So Polynice decided that Seabrook should meet some zombies himself to see if they actually exist. And this he actually did. He went with Seabrook while travelling by horse along a trail in the Haitian countryside. Polynice pointed to a woman with three men with who were working in the plantations about 100 yards or so off the trail. He and Seabrook approached the men, and Seabrook went to greet one of them. He extended his arm towards him, and Seabrook noticed straight away that their movements weren't natural. Polynice touched upon one of the men on the shoulder, motioned to him to stand up, and slowly the poor fellow slowly rose to his feet. What Seabrook saw caused a moment of genuine fear, I would say. The man's eyes were unfocused. They were completely unfocused on anything in particular, and his face was completely devoid of any expression or emotion. Seabrook went on to comment that these poor men were probably had a similar expression to a dog that he had seen that had been lobotomized, actually, in a histological lab. The dog was alive, but its face was completely blank, and Seabrook felt that this was very similar to what he had seen in the zombies that he witnessed with Polynice. He took the man by the hand, said to the bocor, he said to him, bonjour compère, which means hello friend. But the only response from the zombie's master was that he got angry, basically, and pushed Seabrook away.
Goodness.
I mean, Seabrook basically thought that the zombies were just people who were deranged, like mentally disabled, which is probably right, which seems to be actually be the case.
Yeah.
But Polynice assured him that the zombies, they regularly turn up in Haiti, and they've been recognised by friends and family for hundreds of years. There's something more to it than just that.
Absolutely. And I think we often forget the impact that Seabrook's book had, because it was adapted, I believe, The Magic Island into one of the first of the talking horror films, which is White Zombie, which had a lot of basis in that. And I think it's very interesting that prior to Seabrook, it didn't really seem to be investigated or known about that well. And yet, for probably the next 10 years, it really seems to have caught on a great deal, especially when it came to American folklore and entertainment, Carl, yeah. that it seemed that everybody was really interested in these zombies. And obviously that's the period where Zora Neale Hurston sort of dove into this as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. It was very, very popular at the time.
So from Seabrook's writings and his sort of experience of that, where did this sort of investigation and the knowledge begin to build in regards to what was causing the zombies and how people began to theorise what these sort of masters were able to do with these people, Carl?
Well, it took a very, very, very long time. It basically started off as very much as folklore. The zombie, according to folklore, is created through magic. You know, many different methods are said to be used, even apparently sucking a person's soul through the crack under a door or through a window or something like that. However, according to the actual Bokors themselves, it's something far more nefarious. According to them, a zombie is created using a mixture of sorcery and magic, and most importantly, two very important and secret powders.
Yes, because I think for a lot of people, I suppose a lot of people were quite sort of flippant about this and just didn't believe it, did they? They just thought, well, you know, they were looking on this as a unsubstantiated rumours and just exaggeration, really. So
yeah,
it then starts becoming apparent that, as you refer to there, it does have some basis in fact. So when did people start to really sort of take this seriously and think, well, what is causing this or what can cause this?
I would say it was after the studies by Wade Davis on the island. He deduced that there was two powders, like I say. Powder one creates the death-like appearance of the victim, which is said to be profound enough to fool Western physicians. According to the biochemical studies of Wade Davis, the primary components of the powder are human bones, one or two species of pufferfish, which during the reproductive season contain a deadly neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin, known as TTX. TTX causes loss of sensation and paralysis of the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles, which basically slows down breathing to basically not being noticed. So it's hypothetical, that TTX could be administered in the correct amounts. It could create a death-like appearance. Other ingredients are the marine toad of the genus Buphomerus, the Hyla tree frog, and various other plants and animal ingredients like lizards and spiders and things like that.
Mm.
Yeah, they're usually ground down into a paste, which is then buried for a period of time. And it's usually buried along with something of the victim as well, which is obviously a spiritual aspect which is attached to it. So it becomes a powder, which is either blown into the intended victim's face or placed on the ground outside the victim's door. In fact, I always wonder whether or not the placing of the powder on the door actually might have something to do with the folklore we were talking about previously of the Bokor sucking the soul out from under the door, perhaps.
Mm.
It could be some sort of link there, I think.
I mean, it is very interesting that whatever was going on in regards to the people that were being attacked in these ways, Carl, I've often found it really interesting that the Bokor seems to have complete control over them. Has anybody kind of looked into why this person is able to kind of control these people? And I've often always found it odd as well that when we're talking about the victims of this process, they seem to be very sluggish and dull in their responses and their movements, Carl. So without sounding churlish, I've never really understood how this is benefiting a Bokor, because the zombie seems to be very sort of sedentary in the way it responds to anything, even chores. So I don't often find it strange that these people are subjected to this, because it seems a very hard way to get somebody completely under your control.
Yeah, I mean, they are really put onto menial tasks, so grinding corn or working with the sugarcane fields, things like that. That's all they really do. But there is an idea in Haiti that there's a secret police that actually do this, and they do it for various other reasons as well, through punishment, because it's actually part of the Haitian criminal code, the Haitian penal code. They actually mention zombies, which I think is quite interesting. Also, it shall be qualified as attempted murder the employment which may be made against any person of substance which, without causing actual death, produce a lethargic coma more or less prolonged. After administering such substances, the public who has been buried, the act shall be considered murder no matter what result follows. Now, that is actually officially Article 246 of the Haitian Penal Code.
Mm.
So something very, very real taking place. Whether or not we fully understand it from our Western perspective, I'm not sure. But there's something very, very dodgy taking place in Haiti.
Other than the like you say, clearly something had been going on for this to be added into the Haitian Penal Code. So clearly the authorities were aware that this phenomenon was occurring and going on.
Yeah.
So when Seabrook and then Zora Neale Hurston kind of dragged this subject into the mainstream, as it were. Obviously, Hurston's famous case involved a lady called Felicia Felix Mentor.
Yes.
And this is one of those cases where she'd apparently been buried, and then she kind of was she found on the street by her family or something, and they kind of realised that this was this member of their family that they believed had passed on.
That's exactly what happened, yeah, and that's happened several times.
Seabrook obviously featured a very well-known case in his work, Carl. So, for anybody who's not read The Magic Island or seen White Zombie, could you sort of dive into that and tell us about this particular person that Seabrook encountered and what was going on in that case?
Yeah, he encountered a guy called Polonese, who we talked about earlier, and he basically took Seabrook out to see some zombies in the fields, in the cane fields. He approached them, he greeted one of them, and he basically, the first descriptions of the zombie are all based off what Seabrook claimed from that particular encounter. Obviously, he wrote it down in The Magic Isle, which is his book from the 1920s. And that, let's say, became White Zombie. Then the zombie took over mainstream culture and became, slowly, after about 70 years, what it is today.
So, obviously, what I've always found really interesting, when it comes to things like this, there are deeply culturally important, I think. I've often found it really peculiar when it comes to the zombie, Carl, that it completely seems to drop out of favour, both in a folkloric sense, that after the sort of 1930s, people seem to lose interest in the subject and don't really seem to be very interested in following up the works of Neale Hurston and Seabrook in regards to what they'd uncovered during the 20s and 30s, Carl. And then it kind of just sort of drifts along for the best part of 50 years. Do you have any sort of indication or thoughts in regards to that before, obviously, the modern zombie kind of comes back into fashion?
Well, public opinion of Haiti had changed in that time, and it wasn't very much happening, I suppose. So the zombie reflects the political situation at the time, I would say. So in the 1920s, you know, that was relevant then, and it became relevant again in the 1950s with François Duvalier, who was the dictator, and then later his son, Papa Doc Duvalier.
Mm.
And they were actually, Papa Doc, he created a secret police force called the Tonton Macoute, and they claimed to be witch doctors because they were basically creating a fear campaign in Haiti. And that brought it back to public attention.
Ah, because I've seen a few people say that the interesting thing is obviously when in the modern era, other than the political situation that had gone on in Haiti, for a lot of people, they tend to sort of look at Night of the Living Dead as the sort of cultural renaissance of the zombie. And it's one of those interesting things, Carl, because the term zombie is never mentioned in that film at all. And I believe Romero actually based it on Matheson's story, I Am Legend, which is more to do with vampirism than anything. And once again, we seem to have this connection with the Revenant legend influencing it. But clearly, from that point on, Romero embraced the zombie entirely in the sequels and his subsequent work up until his passing a few years ago. So, in regards to that aspect of it, when do we get this change in what the zombie is? Because, obviously, from that point on in the late 60s, zombies then become fashionable and have become a mainstay of horror. Yes, they drop in and out of fashion, and they're currently going through, as we said earlier, this sort of renaissance over the last decade or so.
Mm.
But it's very interesting that it seems that once again, the kind of investigation and history of the real zombie seems to have completely dropped out of fashion until, like we mentioned earlier, Wade Davis, who was a Harvard ethnobotanist, and his work that ended up becoming the Serpent and the Rainbow, and obviously his follow-up to that, Passage of Darkness.
Yeah.
In regards to Davis's work, Carl, what sort of What was his sort of interest in it? Why did he sort of go back to this work that had kind of been put on a shelf for 50, 60 years?
He had been made aware of the case of Clavius Narses, who was a very, very, very famous zombie in the early 80s, where he was in all the newspapers, he would be on the telly a lot, and it was well known. So basically, he went to go see him. He is absolutely the most famous case of a Haitian zombie, I would say. He had, among other things, broken one of Haiti's traditional behavioural codes by abandoning his children. He's also said to have cheated his brother out of inheriting land from his dead father. So it's said that one of his many descriptions, he was made into a zombie as punishment by the equivalent of the Tonton Macoute. And basically he stayed a zombie until the death of his master, which he basically thought was a magic spell had ended. But obviously, if you're not going to be looked at like that, you could just say that maybe the zombie master wasn't giving him the powder anymore. But basically it wore off and he returned to his village, and he was found by his sister, and he introduced himself by a childhood nickname that nobody else would have known. And he also knew things about his childhood which he shouldn't have known, and he became a very famous case.
Yeah, because it is very odd, because he's another one, as we mentioned in one of the other famous cases, that he, I believe, on top of all this social issues that he'd had with his family, and like you say, sort of, that's why people believe he was earmarked, because he was sort of pushed to the fringes of society by his behaviour, Carl.
Yep.
That obviously he became a sort of target for a local bokeur to take advantage of. But he was one of those where he went into hospital, and once again, he was supposed to have died and been buried, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. He was admitted to the Albert Schweitzer Hospital on April 30th, 1962, with fever and fatigue. I think he was also spitting up blood. Doctors couldn't find the cause, and he eventually grew worse. He appeared to die about 3 days later and was pronounced dead by two Western trained physicians. And then, say, like we said, then back in 1980, a man identifying himself as Clavius Narses approached his sister, claiming to be her brother, and he used a childhood nickname. And he also knew very intimate family information.
When it comes to Narses, is as you say there, did they find out why like you say, was it that the fact that his bokeur had passed on, or had simply stopped giving him this substance that had caused him to be under his control for some reason, Carl? And it just basically, where did they go from that on? Because obviously I think there's a lot of stuff that talks about Narses when he arrived. So what happened to him from that point of him coming back and saying, this is me and this is what happened? How was he sort of, was his case sort of investigated? Did he go under any sort of medical examinations and talk about what had happened to him?
First of all, he was put in cold storage for 20 hours and pronounced dead by two Western physicians. I don't know if you've seen The Servant and the Rainbow, the film, but it shows you one of the methods there, which they use to see if somebody's alive or dead, and that's basically just pushing a needle into the white of the eye and seeing if there's like a twitch, a flicker.
Mm.
But he was actually checked out by two Western-trained physicians who actually said that he was definitely dead, and apparently was put into cold storage. So really, in terms of biology, it's impossible. But this person did turn up again, and they did claim to be Clavius Narses, and they knew things he shouldn't have known. And he matched it up almost perfectly to the picture on his death certificate, which was signed by his sister.
I mean, that is remarkable, because obviously we do have this medical... I mean, this is not unverified information either, Carl, is it? This is a matter This is a matter of fact. This guy was supposed to have died.
Yep, something very real is happening.
And so I would imagine that this case kind of dragged it back in, because as you say, especially because what was going on politically, I'm often very surprised as well that this case was able to get out and became so well known because of everything that was going on in the country at that time.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting for me that obviously Davis found this case so intriguing that he had to sort of come over and dive into it, because this is where we began to look at where these neurotoxins were being administered and how this was all working, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was Wade Davis's theory. The TTX theory is all down to Wade Davis's research, and I think quite a few other researchers haven't come up with the same results since, but you know, it's still very much open to interpretation, I believe. But like I say, there's something going on in Haiti. It needs to be investigated.
How is the zombie viewed from this point on in Haitian culture now then, Carl? Because obviously, is this supposed to still go on?
Yes. I mean, in Haiti, people aren't afraid of the zombies. It's not like Western culture where we fear zombies, you know, flesh-eating zombies and all that. In Haiti, people aren't afraid of zombies. They are afraid of becoming a zombie because it symbolises their freedom being taken from them. I don't think there's any coincidence that the Haitian bogeyman, if you like, is a slave.
Mm. This aspect of it as well is when did this sort of change come in to what the zombie can do? Because as we realise and we've spoken about here, Carl, the Haitian zombie is a real phenomenon. It's recorded with several notable cases. It's been investigated by scholars and writers and investigators for decades.
Scientists, yeah.
So when did the cinematic change occur? Because obviously this is the key aspect of the zombie in real life is not a flesh-eating, brain-munching creature. It's essentially a subservient slave that doesn't answer back and is simply does its tasks as it's told. Whereas the one we've got in cinema and television and culture is completely different, isn't it?
It slowly evolved into that. But like I say, the very first zombie movies in the 1930s were all based basically off Seabrook's encounter. So they're very much voodoo zombies. And then slowly zombies, like you say, they reflect the political situation of the time. So into the 1950s, you've suddenly got the atomic zombies. You know, suddenly atomic warfare is a genuine concern. So radiation and things like that are attached to zombies. And into the 1960s, you've got the war on Vietnam and opinions changing there. And I think at some point they just thought, well, you know, zombies are pretty good. You don't have to pay anybody any rights for using them because apparently, it's not like Dracula, you know, apparently zombies are real, so you don't have to pay any rights. But they don't really do anything, do they? So I think somebody at some point just thought, I know, we'll make them bite people. And whether that was George Romero, I don't know, but he certainly adopted that idea and put it into the mainstream. And then zombies then evolved into a flesh-eating creature, which in the 80s became a brain-eating creature and it's just evolved over the years. But it reflects public opinion and the political situation at the time, much like the real zombie.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting that it, as a cultural icon, it seems to symbolise everything that's wrong in the modern world, Carl. Zombies are seen as the end result of all kinds of things, from pandemics to illegal testings of substances and, you know, shady government organisations doing illegal experiments in secure facilities and it's always something escapes and then all hell breaks loose. So in regards to this, I think often, it's, for me, a very interesting of this aspect is that often people will look at this subject in sort of a bigger picture view and look at things such as Mary Shelley and saying that you can kind of say that perhaps Frankenstein's monster is this kind of character, as well as some of Lovecraft's early work, where they're talking about the undead and experimentation that creates autonomous monosyllabic creatures that do their owner's will, as it were.
Mm, absolutely.
So for that kind of aspect of it, that's a very similar kind of, you know, there's a big parallel there between the real cases and obviously the cinematic and literary versions of it. So when we look at it overall, how do you think that the zombie has kind of evolved in that way?
I think it was a natural progression. You know, that's just how it was going to happen. The zombie in Haiti is the same, and it always has been the same. It's never changed. The idea of that has been passed on to other places around the world now, and it's slightly evolved with that. But the zombie, the original zombie, is always been a slave, an undead slave, and only undead in the sense that that they're basically brain dead. You know, the perception of death in Haiti is very, very different to it is in the Western world.
Mm.
You also got to remember as well that in Haiti, where refrigeration is basically non-existent, for corpses is not in the best condition, shall we say. The standard thing is to bury as quickly as possible. And now, they're not always buried 6 feet down either. They're usually buried about 3 feet down and buried in loose rubble. So eventually a heavy coffin is then placed on top of the grave, and that should be enough then to deter the grave robbers, the necromancers and the bokors from digging up the body. But that's all very real. You know, this is all stuff that really, really does happen. Unlike the Hollywood zombies, where it's very much made up, it's very much fictional.
Yes. Well, we hope.
We do.
I mean, that's one of the great aspects of Max Brooks's work in both the Zombie Survival Handbook, which is a fabulous and humorous take on this all, and obviously his outstanding World War Z. Less said about the film version, the better. But I really liked one of the aspects of Brooks's first book, The Zombie Handbook, The Survival Guide, when it's got this list of incidents at the back of it. And it's one of those that, yes, it's a humorous book, and it's obviously done with its tongue firmly in its cheek, Carl. But I think there's a lot of the zombie cinematic mythos that buys into this kind of conspiracy theory aspect of it, that when there are major incidents and things like that, Brooks kind of says, oh, well, you know, these weren't accidents, these weren't incidents, these were actually zombie outbreaks. And it's quite a humorous take on that aspect of it, that it does, even though you know it's pulling your leg a little bit, it is tempting to kind of sometimes take a step back and think, well, is it what they told us?
Yeah, it's written so well, isn't it? It really makes you question that.
Yeah, I mean, World War Z is just a fabulous piece of work. I just found that whole situation. That was, once again, it's one of those where the other aspect of the modern zombie now, outside of the Haitian version, is that it seems to be popular across the world, Carl, which I find it's one of those things that ghosts, vampires, monsters, zombies are something that seem to have really caught the imagination of places that probably don't have a history of it. When you look at, for example, what some of the films that came out of Asia in the sort of late 90s and early noughties, because that had a lot to do with making zombies popular again, because other than a few horror films in the 80s from the States, that's been about it, really. And then you can kind of see from that point on, the last 20 years, it's really taken off, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's encouraged the Resident Evil franchise too, which is really what, you know, Resident Evil, the first Resident Evil, really is the very first big budget zombie film ever made.
Mm.
You know, its entire history from 1932 to 2001, you know, so we're talking 70 odd years. All zombies were basically in the B movie category. But that's what changed that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's one of the aspects of zombies that some people don't sort of give enough kudos to, because Resident Evil was such a popular franchise as a game. And I remember going to see the first one. I thought the first film was rather well done.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because obviously after that, we start to get some absolutely fabulous films. I know a bone of contention for the director is obviously 28 Days Later, because Danny Boyle says that's not a zombie film, but everybody else who watches it, and a lot of people who love it, clearly think it is.
I think it's a zombie by any other name. You know, it's basically, it's the precepts of a zombie film. It's just that technically, within that particular storyline, he's written it so they're not dead. That's the only difference.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a zombie movie. It's just that they're breathing in it.
Yes. Yeah, 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 absolutely. Because it's, I mean, that's the other aspect of the zombie as well, is that in some of the older films, and it's only sort of in the modern era that they tend to it's the dead feasting on the living, whereas we've sort of seen over the last 20 years that it's sort of become some kind of, people become zombies from being bitten, it's transfer of fluid or saliva or a bite or something like that, Carl, and I mean,
whatever we're afraid of at the time.
Yes.
At the moment, we're afraid of viruses.
yeah, well, exactly, and I think that's, I mean, that's the other thing, that, I mean, that's what Resident Evil, that's where the zombies come from in there, isn't it? Because that's an airborne virus that creates it, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's one of those viruses that jumps.
Mm.
I think it's... you know, it can be in the air, it can be in the water. It's,
yeah.
But that's very much influential on the zombie of today. You know, Resident Evil basically created it. You know, it was based off George Romero's original plan, but it was updated for Resident Evil. And you can see throughout the Resident Evil movies, the zombies pick up their pace, they get faster. You know, and that just makes for a faster-paced film. That's really all that is.
Mm.
Sorry, World War Z, that's about the fastest zombies I've ever seen. how a dead person could move at that speed, I have no idea.
Well, I suppose they're not going to get any sort of, you know, lactic acid, Carl.
I mean, I always thought that, you know, they're lucky enough walking around and bumping into things, you know, to be running around. And, yeah, it takes it away from horror, I think.
Mm. I must admit, one of my favourite films of the last 10 years is Train to Busan, which I think is phenomenal.
Absolutely brilliant.
And that's a very interesting aspect of it, because the thing about Busan is that often we will see in more Western films that if somebody gets taken down by zombies or whatever, they tend to be dead for quite a while. Whereas in Busan, basically you get bit and you've got about 30 seconds, it seems, depending on how strenuous the bite is.
But again, that's just a mechanism in the film to create an even faster pace.
Yes.
You know, it just makes a faster paced film, but I don't think that makes it any more believable. You know, the zombies that genuinely put a fear into me are the very slow ones that, you know, you think, what is that? Is that a person? You know, when they're running around, I think it just changes the dynamic of the story.
Yeah, very much so. And I think often the thing about the zombie is the most terrifying aspect of it, especially cinematic, is simply the sheer number of them.
Mm. Yeah, they say that vampires attack an individual, but the zombie attacks a population, attacks everybody, which is far more frightening, especially in today's society where we're more conscious now of the effects of viruses after COVID. In fact, there is actually a film that's coming out soon, or it's just come out, called COVID Zombies. So that just shows you how it's encouraging how the films are made.
Yeah, and I find it quite interesting that when it comes to zombies in cinema now, Carl, we do seem to have moved away from this kind of, I mean, that, because I'm trying to think here, and I might be wrong, but I can't remember if in Night of the Living Dead, why we're told they come back.
We're not. It's hinted to us that it's a satellite re-entering orbit, and it's something to do with radiation that's been spilled from it, but they don't actually verify that in the film itself. And George Romero carries on with that throughout the series. You know, he keeps it ambiguous. He does it. It's scarier when you don't know the reason why.
Mm. Obviously, another one of my favourites, and some people hate this film, and I don't understand, is Return of the Living Dead from the 1985. I even, you know, I quite like the second one. The less said about the third one.
even less about 4 and 5.
yeah, I think I lasted 30 minutes in the fourth one. The third one's just very strange. Primarily,
you know what? I quite like the third one. I like the Romeo and Juliet style to it.
Well, yeah. It is a bit strange like that. True love never dies, it would seem. and that's a very interesting sort of other aspect of this, is that often when we talk about zombies in cinema, there is often sometimes this sort of attempt to create this sort of mental battle between this infection of whatever it is, Carl, taking over the mind, that eventually, no matter how much someone tries to deal with it, they eventually succumb to this infection and have this bloodlust, which is a prime example of that in Return of the Living Dead 3.
Yeah.
But the second, as I was back to the original two, that the thing that always interested me in that one is that Return of the Living Dead is the archetypal shady government canisters, get lost, kids find them, accidentally open it, all hell breaks loose. So it seems that then we now have, unlike, say, vampires or creatures or aliens or something like that, when it comes to the zombie, there seems to be several ways, it would seem, in cinema now that these infections and explosions can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's interesting that it now has so many strands to how they're created? Or do you think that's just the natural evolution? Because I find it odd that it's got so many starting points for them.
Well, I do find it that the natural evolution, like you say, it's just set up like that. You know, we've got so many options now. Who's to say what they're going to be doing in 10 years' time? I imagine there might be a lot more zombie films that reference Corona, probably. Like I said before, they reflect whatever's happening at the time. So back in the 30s, that was racial stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, that was radiation, nuclear war, and now it's viral very much.
Do you have any personal favourite zombie films that you think more people should be aware of? One of my personal favourites is obviously Peter Jackson's wonderful Brain Dead.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
What about yourself?
I was speaking to the guy out of Brain Dead the other day, by the way. I think it was Brain Dead. Was he the one that had the weird Nazi guy in it that was poking something, I think, in a jar or something like that? I spoke to him because he's actually a judge on the 40M Film Festival, which I'm also a judge for, so I was speaking to him. Brian somebody. Really nice guy.
Yeah, because he's the guy that gets that, what is it, a Sumatran rat monkey or whatever it is that causes it all.
Yeah, and that's a really good example, isn't it? You know, that's crazy, that one is, but very entertaining.
Sumatran
rat monkey.
Yeah, I think it's crazy when you look at some of Peter Jackson's early films and you look at what he's, you know, here's the guy that gave us Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit trilogy and obviously did King Kong and others. And it's when you look at, I mean, Brain Dead as a zombie film as well, Brain Dead is particularly unusual because it's one of the rare examples of a horror comedy that you've gotten, that just really, really kind of makes you feel very uncomfortable laughing at some of the things that go on in that film.
I think that film, his first two films, in fact, they show that he had so much potential as a director. I can see why film companies were interested in him, because he makes magic happen with little or no money.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, I mean, I'm thinking, I mean, that's another one where you've got a situation where it's clearly obvious that something horrible's going on and people are just trying their best to avoid it until, obviously, things get completely out of hand, Carl.
Yeah, they really do. I seem to remember a Catholic priest saying that he kicks ass for the Lord or something like that.
Yeah, they have the kung fu zombie fight in the graveyard.
That's right, yeah.
Which obviously has an untimely finale to it, but I still find it odd that people haven't seen that film because it's 30 years old. But is there any others that you're a big fan of, Carl, that you really like for perhaps?
I really like Italian zombie movies. They're probably my favourite subgenre, if you like.
Mm.
Probably Zombie Flesh Eaters is probably the most famous by Lucio Fulci.
Yeah.
That was actually sold in Europe as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead. So
yes.
In Europe, Dawn of the Dead was called Zombie, and Zombie Flesh Eaters was sold as Zombie 2.
Mm.
That happened a lot in Italian cinema. You get lots of films that are just sort of lumped on at the end. They've got nothing to do with it. The Spanish make some really good zombie films too, like the Blind Dead series.
Mm.
Amanda D'Ossario's Tombs of the Blind Dead, Return of the Blind Dead, The Ghost Galleon, and Night of the Seagulls. They're all well worth checking out. They're about blind zombies that are from the Knights Templar.
Mm.
They hunt by sound. It's really, really great. In the early 1970s. There's lots. I mean, at the moment, right now, I'm looking at my zombie movie collection. I've got about 400 films. Yeah, so anything for the Italians is very good, usually very gory, like The Beyond, House by the Cemetery by Lucio Fulci, the Italians, the Spanish, they're great. Yeah, there's literally hundreds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another one that it's one of those films, I saw it accidentally, and there's a couple of these that I've seen over the years. So it's a Japanese film, Carl, called Versus.
Oh, yeah, I've got that. Yeah, great.
Now, that is one of those films that I can't remember how I ended up watching. I love it when I discover films like this, where I'm just, I think I probably saw it on Film 4 at 1 o'clock in the morning once, I think, and I just absolutely loved it. And then one of my friends was working out in Hong Kong and picked up a copy for me and fetched it back. And that's one of those films that when I show it to friends, they all kind of give me a funny look. But that's amazing.
It's just gotten a really interesting story. It's fast-paced and it's fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's a great film.
But that's obviously a strange one, because that seems to be, if I remember correctly, because it's been a couple of years since I last watched it, aren't they coming through some kind of portal from hell in that one? They're like demons, yeah. Which is very interesting, because often The Evil Dead is often put forward as a zombie film when it's really more to do with demonic possession of dead bodies rather than them being zombies, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Evil Dead 2 is the only one that actually has real zombies in it, because there's skeletons, aren't there?
Yes.
But yeah, apart from that, it's all demons, yeah.
Mm. So, like I say, I mean, Fulci's films are well known. I'm trying to think is one of Fulci's films one of those where they have that horrific scene involving the eyeball.
It is, that's zombie flesh eaters.
Yes, that scene has stayed with me a very, very long time.
Very, very gory and very drawn out.
Yeah, it seems to take forever.
It doesn't cut away, does it? It just makes you sit through the entire thing.
Yeah, it's not good. Not good at all. So is there any aspects of it? I mean, do you have any sort of part of it? Because the other thing I think now is, do you think when it comes to zombie cinema and especially with television, do you think it's in danger now of it's hit its saturation point, Carl, that we often see with this kind of thing, that they seem to be everywhere for 10 years and then all of a sudden the quality seems to fall?
That's a cycle that keeps reoccurring. You know, back in the late 1980s, the zombie genre was seriously wearing itself out. And by the 1990s, I think after films like Cemetery Man, Della Morte, Della More, which is another Italian film, I think after that, there's literally nothing that's any good all the way up until Resident Evil in 2001. And then obviously it picked up, and now it's at that peak now, but I think it's about to die off again. But who knows, in future, that's the beauty of the zombie genre. It will just keep, it'll keep resurrecting.
Just like the zombie.
Yeah.
So, as you touched on a bit ago, Carl, you were talking about the 14 Film Festival and you being a judge in that. And I know that's something that seems to be growing. So, what's been going on with that, and what kind of aspects of judging do you have to get involved in regards to that, and what kind of categories does it cover?
It covers anything 14, really. So anything that's a bit unusual, that's got a kernel of reality to it. There's always, I think they get about 400 films put forward every week to go into the film festival. So they're doing really well. And I think by next year, it's probably going to be even bigger than it was last year. So yeah, watch this space, I think. It's going to be a big deal.
Absolutely. Was there any particular highlights from the most recent one? Anything that you think we should hunt down and watch?
Well, I definitely think you should check out Cat Hunters, because I was in that one. that's coming out soon. I'm not sure exactly who's buying that, but that'll be coming out in the next year or so, I would have thought. That was really good fun, obviously, because I was in that one. But yeah, it's just full of good stuff, full of quality, good quality material.
Ah, excellent. And what's been happening with the Centre for 14 Zoology, Carl? What, have you had any interesting cases that you've had to deal with recently, or anything that's kind of opened your eyes or made you sort of scratch your head in regards to any strange things that currently seem to be being reported around the UK and beyond?
Well, we're just chugging along still, as we usually do. They've been going now since 1992, so we are, you could say, we're the last gang in town. No, not really. Big cats in the Forest of Dean, that's what I've been doing, and I've been still checking out the Lynx reports. I've just finished an article, again, about big cats and little cats and anomalous cats. for the CSN yearbook. So that'll be coming out quite soon. But no, it's been pretty quiet, really, because obviously COVID stops us travelling around the world. But that's something we're hoping to rectify very, very soon, because I think we need to probably up our game as well and start doing some expeditions around the world, which have got far better chances of biological tenability. I think a good thing to do is to look for cats. Cats are like the perfect cryptid in my view, because cats, as we all know, are massively elusive and they're fascinating animals, you know. So I think that the study of big cats around the world is a viable thing for cryptozoology and something that we should focus on in future.
Yeah. So when's the 14 yearbook out, Carl? As you referred to there, you've submitted an article or two to be included in that. So do you know when that's coming out?
I would imagine it will be out in the next 6 months.
Brilliant. So what else is on your plate? What have you got going forwards, as you referred to? Are there any expeditions that you're eager to kind of get funded for and get out?
I'm at the moment trying to get funding for an expedition to Papua New Guinea, because I believe that the thylacine, the Tasmanian wolf, has the best chances of survival on that island. I think there's a good chance in New Zealand and there's a slim chance in Australia, but I think that the most likely place that animal is going to exist is going to be Papua New Guinea, simply because the place is so, so wild.
Yeah, there seems to be some a long history of strange creatures out in Papua New Guinea. I know there are certain reports of large lizards being out there as well, Carl. So when it comes to places like this out in the Pacific, do you think that because of their remoteness and their sort of isolation, even though they are, you know, they have all the modern amenities and connections that we are all very aware of and use daily now, do you think that ecologically, these are the safest environments for some of these lost creatures?
I do. And in fact, I always say we should, all cryptozoologists should maybe pay attention to this. I think that we should always use ecology first. Ecology should always be our primary line of data. And if the cryptozoological data affirms the ecological data, then we study it. If it doesn't, then we don't bother, which is why there are no Bigfoots, no biological Bigfoots in Britain. You know, things like that, because it's just impossible. The country itself is not capable of sustaining them and hiding them from science indefinitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I often remember having a conversation with Nick Redfern, and he was talking about you start with the food source, and if the food source isn't there, then the creature isn't there. And as you refer to there, when we're talking about this ongoing situation here in the UK with big cats, Carl, are you still getting as many reports coming into the CFZ?
Never stops. We get big cat reports every 3 or 4 days.
Really?
From all over the country. Yeah. Well, not just all over the country, all over the world, in fact.
So have you had any kind of, how many reports would you say have come in recently that have made you go blimey? Because obviously a lot of places, as you mentioned there, Forest of Dean, and obviously there are famous cases on, you know, Dartmoor and Exmoor. Have you had any reports from sort of places that have made you think, that is unusual?
There are always reports from built-up areas. You get reports from the middle of cities, which I think are very, very unlikely. The biggest problem with the big cat phenomenon is that we've got a genetic imprint, a genetic memory that tells us to avoid animals of that shape, because at one time we were, hiding up trees in Africa and these animals were dangerous to us. So now when we see something we don't see quite clearly, our brain tells us that we've just seen a predator and to avoid it. And I think a lot of the big cat reports from this country, that's all they are. But that doesn't mean that's all they are. You know, there is plenty of other data out there which certainly implies that there is at least a small population that may or may not be breeding.
I found it interesting recently that there seems to be a growing suspicion, Carl, that without wishing to point towards conspiracy theories and cover-ups, there seems to be a real conversation developing that a lot of people are coming to the opinion that the authorities are very aware of this situation and are simply ignoring it for as long as possible. Do you think that there is any validity in some of these theories that have started to gain traction over the last 6 months to 12 months?
Some of them, yeah. I always avoid the hybrid theory as much as possible because I don't think the British population, if you like, could be sustained through different species hybridizing with each other. But in the wild, these animals are more likely to fight or just avoid each other completely. And they can pick up each other from their scent, from their urine they put down. And they can tell things like how healthy the animal is, what species it is, you know, whether it's pregnant, things like that. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say really, but I don't think that the hybrid theory is particularly viable, even though I do suspect it probably has happened a couple of times.
Mm.
But I don't think it's a big component of the British phenomena.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when we see what's happened in say, US with coyotes and wolves, and I think often we can look at an explanation that has factual and scientific data now, Carl, like we have with coy wolves.
Mm.
And things like pizzlies, and we would tend to then try and fit that kind of factual explanation into something that as yet hasn't been categorically proven, despite the fact that, you know, there have been several non-native big cats killed in this country. That is that is a matter of record. It is clearly shown.
Alive.
Yes, absolutely. I remember Carl Schuker's fabulous article several years ago in the 14 Times, which kind of catalogued dozens of cases, Carl, of non-native species that had been killed, run over, as you say, captured alive. Eventually, you'll get to a point where these can't all be exotic pets that have escaped, can they?
No, and I think that once we start finding animals that look like they've been out for, you know, months at a time, and we study what they've been eating and things, I think that sort of evidence will come forward then, and we'll see that breeding does take place. It's just not how the British population as a whole are sustained. There's a little bit of breeding takes place, but in general, we've still got an illegal pet trade. And the animals that get released, they're basically, the gene pool is being topped up by new escapees or by new released animals.
Mm. I was fascinated to see over the last few months, Carl, that people seem to be buying servals for pets.
Yeah.
Which I find absolutely gobsmacking.
Yeah.
Is this legal, first of all? and if so, at the end of the day, how on earth can anybody, I mean, this is the old aspect of things like this, Carl, is that at the end of the day, these are wild animals. They are not domesticated cats, aren't they? And it's, from what I gather, people seem to be crossbreeding them. Is that right?
That's right, they are. There's all sorts of hybrids being produced. For instance, the Savannah cat. The Savannah cat is a hybrid between the serval, like you say, and the domestic cat. And I think most of the cats that we see in this country, the spotted cats that people think are actually leopards, are actually Savannah cats. There's a cat that I photographed very recently, which has been recently published in on the Track of Unknown Animals, our internet web program. And I filmed something in that, which is clearly a hybrid between a Sphinx-type cat and a Bengal leopard-type cat. So that sort of hybridization keeps occurring. And it's obviously a huge factor in the British situation.
What is the attraction to the serval, Carl? Why are people being very attracted to this? Because, you know, as I touched on, it's a wild animal. Yes, they are beautiful. But I don't understand what is the attraction of owning a wild cat?
I think it's status symbol to a certain extent. I think animals like servals and Savannah cats, it's just somebody who's got one and they want to show off to their friends that they've got such an amazing cat, and that's all that is. And that carries on to those unscrupulous types. For instance, you get drug dealers that will have pumas and leopards and things like that as a status symbol for them too, for their purposes. So again, 9 times out of 10, there are animals that are pets and they've escaped. And if the animal's lucky enough, it'll come across a member of its own species that's already escaped and will potentially breed and produce first, second gen offspring. But in general, I think that the British situation is is held up by escapees and new released animals.
Yeah, so that's still going on then.
So there's not much of a mystery, really. I don't think there's really that much of a mystery with the big cat situation in Britain. I think it just gets blown out of hand. They are there, there's just not many of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, cats in general are extremely reclusive. You only have to look at some of the difficulties people have had trying to film snow leopards, you know, in areas they know exist. And it takes months, years even, to get clear and obvious footage of these creatures, Carl. So, as you say, if you're dealing with an animal that is known for being intelligent, likes to keep its own space, then essentially they are the living embodiment of searching for a needle in a haystack, aren't they?
Literally, yeah. It's a wandering needle. It doesn't stay still.
So I think, lastly, Carl, is there any other kind of strange creatures that have been reported recently to the Centre of Fortean Zoology? I'm not suggesting any sort of crazy cryptids, but are we still getting crazy reports of things like koi dogs and things like that being turning up on
the country? You get those sorts of things. You get wallabies still turn up, koi poos still turn up. We did get a call recently about some, I'm not sure what species they are, but some very large species of crab with about a metre circumference turning up off the Yorkshire coast. And I think they've been verified now, actually, which is quite interesting. Obviously, we had Wally the Walrus last year, who was doing the rounds. That was pretty exciting. Because to us, cryptozoology is part of zoology. You know, it's just that we are basically looking into a particular type of data that hints towards the more exciting new discoveries. You know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do love a strange animal turning up on British shores, as you say. That walrus was remarkable because it seemed like it had just come to the UK for a break.
That's probably what it did do. And then another one came, didn't it?
Yes.
One.
Yeah. I mean,
who knows?
Yeah, I love it when people say, oh yeah, these are once-in-a-lifetime situations, and then 3 months later, a different one turns up, being like, right, okay, what's going on here?
Years, and then suddenly they should all come, yeah.
I mean, obviously, we've got what's going on out in the US as well at the moment. That Stellar Sea Eagle seems to have suddenly become a massive situation over there as well, which caught a lot of people on the hop, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I was walking my dog recently. It's a different species completely, but I was walking my dog the other day, and we saw a great egret, which is a huge bird. It was actually standing quite close to a heron, and it was bigger than the heron.
Wow!
You know, and if you're not familiar with that species, you would think, oh my God, what is that? Is that some sort of dinosaur or something? You know, and that's where these stories come from.
Yeah. I mean, herons are stunning creatures. And once again, you know, these are a native bird, Carl, that are very rarely seen unless you live in the country and you have the opportunity to have local amenities like rivers.
I'm lucky about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're very fortunate where I am here in Sheffield. There are quite a few herons that fly about. And I often find it very interesting when I'm with someone who's never seen one before.
Yeah.
And that alone seems to cause absolute confusion for people because they are a very unusual bird if you've never seen one, and yet it's a native species to the UK, and still people look at it as if it's some kind of escaped dinosaur or some relic from a bygone era that they weren't aware of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, my friend, what's next for you? What have you got planned? Obviously, as things begin to open back up this year, is it a case of continuing to do your research and being able to actually get out and chase down some of these cases now?
Yeah, and I say at the moment we are fundraising for some expeditions that are coming up. All very, very credible cryptozoological expeditions, I'd like to add. You know, looking for the thylacine in Papua New Guinea, looking for a new species of clouded leopard on Iriomote. Things that are all very viable and successes that cryptozoology actually needs.
Absolutely. So if anybody wants to sort of keep up to date with the work or get hold of yourself, Carl, how can they do that the easiest?
They can do that mainly through going through carl@cfz.co.uk, or they can also get me on carlmarshall83@live.com, or on one of our various Facebook groups.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything and your contacts in the show notes as always, Carl. Thank you so much for taking me on a wonderfully and gory trip into the world of zombies, as well as another update on your fantastic work with the Centre of Fortean Zoology and your continued exploration and touching on one of my favourite subjects, which is our wonderfully secretive population of big cats. Thank you as always, my friend.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure.